Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guests.
Thank you, Sarah. This is Bob Keebler, and I'm here today with Robert Gordon of 21st Securities Corporation in New York, New York. Today, we're going to be talking about investing and tax planning in an ultra-low interest rate environment. Let's just jump right in. Big picture, we have these low interest rates, and what unique tax issues arise when investing in bonds when rates are so low?
Well, I think that investors have to be aware of one of the protections that they can take to not wind up on the bad side of this situation. And what I mean by that is that as interest rates go down, fixed rate securities like bonds adjust to the lower interest rates by their bond prices going up. So as an example, if there was a bond that was issued in the past with a 4% coupon and interest rates start going lower than 4%, the bond starts trading for a higher and higher price. As an example, if the bond had 1 year left to maturity and interest rates were only 1%, the bond would actually be at 103. And the problem is when someone buys that bond for 103 and it's a 4% bond and they don't do anything to protect themselves with a proper election, they're going to wind up with 4% in interest income and 3% in capital losses because they paid 103 for the bond when it matures at 100. And there is an election that a taxpayer can make. It's an election under Section 171. And that election allows them to reduce the taxable income by the premium they paid for the bond. And therefore, instead of paying tax on 4% of interest income and having 3% in capital losses, you would reduce the 4% in interest income by the 3% in amortized loss and leave yourself with just 1% in taxable income, which also matches the economics of the reality of it.
So that election becomes absolutely critical in today's environment because so many bonds are going to be trading at a premium.
That's right. When we're at the lowest point in interest rates, I guess it's safe to assume that every bond that was issued in the past, unless it's a credit issue, is trading at a premium. And everybody should be making this election on taxable bonds. And we could talk about tax-free bonds in a moment.
Bob, before we even go to tax-free bonds, just back up for a second. Most of us in business school would have had this in macroeconomics, and we would have had it in intermediate accounting and maybe a few other places. But conceptually, let's see if I have this right. When interest rates go down, in order for the yield on the bond to reflect current reality, what has to happen, the only thing that can happen, is the bond will trade at a premium. And that brings the interest rate into, so it's in parity with today's market rates. Can you summarize that better than I just did?
No, I think that you're right. It's exactly that. When interest rates go down, bond prices go up. And as bond prices go up from where interest rates were when the bond was issued, the bond price increasing becomes a premium to its par value. And that's the problem we're pointing out, is that when you pay a premium to the maturing value of 100, that you don't want that loss to be a capital loss. You'd like it to instead reduce your taxable income, which you can do by electing under Section 171.
Now let's jump over to the world of munis. So now we're in the tax-exempt world. The bonds trade at a premium. What happens next?
Well, the government here is in the exact opposite position in that they do not want you to be able to have a bond that has a high tax-free coupon and pay a premium and take that premium as a capital loss. So in taxable bonds, you actually have to make the election under Section 171, and I don't know that it's necessary, but it's probably better to attach it to your tax return. And once you make the election under 171, it's permanent, and it only really has to be done once. Whereas in municipal bonds, the government forces you to amortize, and it forces you to take the capital loss and reduce the taxable, the tax-free bond income, which doesn't do you any good. But what it does to do is deny you the capital loss. And what they don't want you to do is be able to get, let's say, high tax-free income and offsetting capital losses by paying a premium. So on muni bonds, the government forces amortization whether you like it or not. There's no election you can make to get in and it or get out of it. So the government has thought through these issues, and the last thing they'd want someone to be able to do is sort of to be gaming the system and buying high coupon premium bonds that are munis in order to get extra tax-free income and extra capital losses.
So are there any tax arbitrage opportunities when rates are so low?
Well, I think there's one that's really pretty easy to do, and most people just aren't very aware of it, and that I find it ironic that the brokerage industry, sort of as a regular business, that when interest rates are high, to suggest that people do bond swaps, which means getting out of one bond, realizing a capital loss, and buying another bond, and there they have to watch out for the wash sale rules and a bunch of other issues. But when interest rates are very low, there's an opportunity to do the sort of the equivalent of a bond swap, which I think makes an awful lot of sense and has very high after-tax returns. And here, it's that what we want you to do is to sell a bond that's a taxable bond that has gone up in price from when you bought it, and you have an unrealized long-term gain. And by doing that, you're actually going to turn what would have been interest income into long-term gain, cutting the tax about in half for most people. So let's talk about how that might work. Let's say that you bought a 4% bond when interest rates were 4%, and now there's 1 year left to maturity, and that bond's trading at 103. If you do nothing over the next year, you're going to receive a 4% interest coupon from the government. That's going to be taxed as interest income, and that's all there is to it. But if you sell the bond at 103 and buy it back again, you're going to have a $3 long-term gain that you realize by selling the bond at 103 that you paid at 100. Theoretically, you can buy back the exact same bond because the wash sale rules aren't in operation when you have a gain for wash gains. There's nothing in the law that says you can't sell something back for a gain and buy it back again within 31 days. So if you literally just sold the bond at 103 and bought it back again, what you would have is a $3 long-term gain, and because you elect to amortize, only 1% in interest income. Who wouldn't rather have $3 of long-term gain and 1% of interest income instead of 4% of interest income? Now, on our website is our article that explains this, but it also has an interactive Excel spreadsheet so that you can see the benefit or costs of doing this, because there are other complications that need to be taken into account. But the fact that the wash sale rule doesn't apply means that you really don't have to change the bond you own like you would have to if you were taking a loss. And again, there are very few people who wouldn't want more long-term gains and less interest income.
Bob, this has been a fascinating interview. Let me summarize what you've covered, and then I have one final question. So what we've learned so far is that with taxable bonds, we need to be careful to make the 171 election, which then allows us to use the premium to offset the income. When we have muni bonds, we're forced to make the 171 election. It's automatic. It's not even an election. and for bonds trading in a premium where you have already built in a long-term capital gain, the smart move is to sell those bonds, take the long-term capital gain, and then repurchase a similar bond so that you can amortize that premium, reducing your interest income. Now, Bob, let me ask you the tough question. Right now, in both Japan and Germany, we have negative interest rates. What happens when you have negative interest rates? How do you handle that from a tax perspective? What does that represent?
Well, I think that that's going to be very problematic in some cases, and in at least one case, the government had a situation where we had bonds being issued at a premium, and those were some TIPS or inflation securities a number of years ago. And the U.S. government had some new regulations as to how you would treat that original issue premium. But I think in other circumstances, the government is silent and is probably going to have to fix the rules because the laws as they are really don't contemplate something called negative interest rates. So just to take it slowly, when you would think maybe that when you invest money in a savings account or a money market fund or whatever it might be, and you make money, you earn interest, and that interest is taxable. And that maybe when there's a negative interest rate, that what you have is interest expense. But unfortunately, the law only allows interest expense for the creation of money and the forbearance of cash, et cetera, and that you're not really creating money by putting money into a bank account and earning less than 0%. What you're really doing is putting money with a bank account and, I guess, being charged a fee for the convenience of leaving it in the bank. The problem is that that fee is going to be a miscellaneous itemized deduction. And under the tax rules that were put in a few years ago, miscellaneous itemized deductions, investment fees, are not deductible. So if you put money into a bank account and that bank account paid minus 1%, you're actually not going to get any deduction for the 1%, which is sort of sad and obviously not what anybody would think would be fair, and maybe it's something the government would fix. On bonds, because of these TIPS that were issued as a premium in the past, the government proposed some regulations and that finalized the regulations. And what those regulations did, it said that the Section 71 amortization, so again, it becomes even more important here, is that the law up until the time the regulations were fixed said that you could reduce the interest income you were going to be taxed by the premium that you paid on the bond under Section 171. But it didn't say anything or didn't contemplate at all what would happen if the premium you were paying on the bond was for more than the interest income on the bond. So let's again buy a bond paying minus 1%. Maybe that would manifest itself as buying a 4% bond with a price of 105. So the first $4 you paid, the $4 of interest income could go against the amortization, but what about the extra dollar that's left over? So these regulations said that the extra amount couldn't be deducted in the current year, but could be deducted at the maturity of the bond under Section 171 and not as interest expense, but as an ordinary deduction. So buying bonds, taxable bonds at a premium that are paying you a negative interest rates will actually give you a good economic and tax answer that is fair and equitable to everybody. Whereas leaving money in the savings account, it seems to me, is not, because the negative interest rate is just going to cause a non-deductible fee. Just to talk about another easy way that what most people do with their cash type investments is people put money into a money market fund. And in a money market fund, you're not buying a bond at a premium so that you can't you know, do an amortization or anything. But I do believe that what's going to happen is that you're going to buy the money market fund at one net asset value, and if there was a negative interest rate, sell it at a lower net asset value, and you'll get a capital loss from that. So to sort of recap, if you bought a taxable bond, regulations were put into place to make sure that whatever you lost became an ordinary deduction, although at the maturity of the bond. If you put money into a savings account, you're going to have a non-deductible miscellaneous itemized deduction investment management fee. And if you owned it, you went into a money market fund, I believe you're going to have a capital loss that you should be able to use like any other capital loss that you would be generating in any other investment. But it gets really, really complicated when people start borrowing at a negative interest rate, and that's going to get crazy. And believe it or not, there are mortgages in Denmark that are at a negative interest rate, meaning that the money you pay back in the mortgage is less than what you borrowed. So do you realize taxable income every time the adjustment is made, or, you know, how does that work? And there's other kinds of things like securities lendings and repos and so forth that I think the government's going to have a real job in front of them if indeed we ever do get into negative interest rates.
Wow. We've covered a lot of ground. I haven't taken that many notes in such a short period of time since graduate school, Bob. That was very interesting. Let's think about this. And so what we have to watch out for is if we ever go to negative interest rates, we're going to have you back, and we're going to have to lay this out with examples, because that's going to be the best way to learn this clearly. We have covered a lot of ground today. On behalf of the PFP section of the AICPA, this has been Bob Keebler with Bob Gordon. If you enjoyed this podcast, we highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website and access more information. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find these valuable resources. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit AICPA.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.